Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. VeritasMedical.com is a website. You can go check out all our archive podcasts there and also on iTunes under You're the Cure. We are super excited today to have a repeat guest. It's been a year, although it kind of in some ways seems like it's been 10 years, but it was late July of 21. We had Dr. Peter McCullough on the show. We were honored to have him bring some truth and clarity on the medical front regarding COVID. And I don't know about you, Dr. McCullough, but I was kind of hoping by now, August of 22, we'd be long gone talking about other things. But here we are, grinding it out. So welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for having me. And let me tell you, I've been very poor in predicting what's going to happen. I never would have guessed we'd be into our third year of this. I thought about today while I walked into the hospital. You know, I'm at a major medical center in Dallas, and we're wearing the masks, and people still have great fear on their minds, and the conversations in the office are not back to usual conversations. They're still very much about the pandemic virus, about risks, about vaccines. We're into the third year, but this 3 years is a long time. I mean, 3 years is a law degree. That's a medicine residency. Yeah. You know, 3 years is a long time. We're well into it. I was on Fox News a few months ago with Laura Ingraham, and I meant to say we're into our third year, but I said we're 3 years into it. And Laura Ingraham goes, Dr. McCullough, it's not 3 years yet, but you know, it will be. Yeah. And the point is, that's a very long time. You know, the Spanish flu pandemic, which was a really serious thing for our country, was a much greater loss of life, and there wasn't any way to manage it fundamentally. It was a worldwide problem. That was 2 years. It was 2 years, and it was done. So we're already past the Spanish flu in terms of something that's influenced us greatly in our lives.
Yeah. Well, how much do you think, in your opinion, is this dragging on because of a lack of proper medical decision-making, meaning vaccinating in the middle of a pandemic, not offering early outpatient care versus more of a political, and again, this is just totally your opinion. I know you're a science guy. You're a man that quotes the literature all the time, but do you have thoughts on that?
Well, let's unpack that. That's actually a great question, one we haven't tackled on the news or other places. So let's unpack this. First thing is, from the very beginning, if we would have done things that really reduce the spread of the virus, what would that have looked like? What we've learned is what reduces the spread of the virus the most is actually using virucidal nasal washes and gargles. So using dilute povidone iodine or dilute hydrogen peroxide, both prevention, you can do it twice a day for prevention, and then four times a day for acute treatment, based on 12 studies, three large randomized trials, massively reduces the viral load, the invasiveness, and the spread of the illness, massively. And it makes sense, because if one is actually killing the virus up in the nasal passages, there's less to be coughed or sneezed out when people, you know, are exhaling or coughing or sneezing. And how that's done is roughly half a teaspoon of povidone iodine, betadine, or half a teaspoon or 3/4 of a teaspoon of hydrogen peroxide in a shot glass of water, 1.5 ounces, a pinch of salt. And over the sink, just get a spray bottle or a little bulb syringe, squirt it up in the nose, sniff it back, and spit it out. You got to choke on a little bit to hit that soft palate and go around. Gargle with the rest. That's very well supported. We've even had members of U.S. Congress say, listen, why isn't that the national policy? Instead of promoting that, believe it or not, the Federal Trade Commission and the FDA has hit every single one of the companies making products, telling them not to advertise for COVID, not to mention it. We've even had one company that wasn't allowed to do research on COVID. The FDA refused to approve their research methods. So I think that was big. The next piece is, when someone gets COVID, then if we would have treated early with all the drugs that we had at our disposal over time, including nutraceuticals and supplements, and you know the big ones, by the way, famotidine. A lot of people don't look at that as a supplement, but it's an oral drug available over the counter. Pepcid, 80 milligrams a day. Certainly zinc, vitamin D, vitamin C, quercetin. But a recent paper by Muro and colleagues from the University of Virginia, those as outpatients who took famotidine and aspirin, that's what they had in their database, 20,000 patients, had a 45% reduction in getting worse and needing oxygen or needing any type of respiratory support. I mean, it's just one study, but there are many. There's just a myriad of studies supporting vitamin D. There's a myriad of studies supporting the other measures. We also have monoclonal antibodies. If they would have been frontlined and maintained an adequate supply chain, we had adequate pre-purchasing, but the government never got the supply chain going. They sequentially pulled them off the market for theoretical reasons, but every single study of monoclonal antibodies showed that they were safe and effective and reduced hospitalization and death. The next layer is the oral antivirals. First year was hydroxychloroquine, second year ivermectin, third year now Paxlovid and molnupiravir. More widespread use of these drugs. We use doxycycline and azithromycin if there's purulent sputum production or bacterial superinfection. Inhaled steroids, budesonide, oral steroids, prednisone, oral colchicine, and then in the very debilitated wheelchair-bound or bed-bound blood thinners. If we would have had a sequential multi-drug approach to treat patients, that would have reduced, over the course of the pandemic, some patients were actually contagious for up to 4 weeks. The average person was contagious 2 weeks. That would have reduced, in aggregate, the period of time that they would have been contagious, each person, probably down to 5 days. Mm-hmm. So when you put all that together, Ben, if we had all those things in place from the very beginning, there just wouldn't have been the spread. Now, the question is, would we ever have gotten to a COVID zero type of U.S., or were we really always in a COVID inevitable U.S.? So even if we would have done those things, would COVID still percolate from person to person no matter what? You know what I mean? That's actually kind of a dilemma to think about that. I really don't know what would be the case. It looks to me like we're almost in a COVID inevitable state. And what I mean by that is that almost every single person's going to get it. It's just a matter of when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just can speak to the things we did decide to do. And I say we, meaning the government, the policymakers, the masks, right. the lockdowns, the distancing, kids stay home from school, just all that kind of stuff. The effectiveness or lack thereof.
Right. So instead of doing everything I mentioned, if everything I mentioned likely would have reduced the case count at any given time, and based on what I said under U.S. and state Senate testimonies, and I've gone back and figured this out, if we would have done exactly what I said based on the learning curve, we would have spared 2/3 of hospitalizations and 2/3 of the deaths. So we would have saved roughly 670,000 lives, and we would have spared probably 6 to 7 million hospitalizations, what I said. What did happen? A massive focus on lockdown, social distancing, and masking. And we had 12 randomized trials in masking, 2 in COVID, 3 very good studies in children showing public masking in general had no impact. Now, as doctors and dentists and other healthcare personnel, we wear masks to reduce large droplet spread in the hospital. We're not talking about that. When we took patients down to the CT scanner who are sick with COVID, we put masks on. We're not talking about that. We're talking about general public masking had no impact, yet that was the major feature of the government response. Social distancing didn't have any impact, and the lockdowns didn't have any impact. In fact, Johns Hopkins commissioned a study, and they found that the lockdowns were essentially useless. So what was proposed back in the fall of 2020, the Great Barrington Declaration by Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, Martin Koldoff from Harvard, and Sunita Gupta from Oxford, was correct, that we should have just had our protection focuses on the seniors. nursing homes, you know, people in senior care facilities, independent living. That's where it was. Everyone else should have, you know, gone about their business as normal. What else did the government do? Well, the government actually actively suppressed treatment. This was a disaster. So we start with the nasal washes. I told you, they actually actively suppressed it, despite people in Congress bringing it up. Companies were discouraged from bringing new products to market. It's not just the povidone iodine and hydrogen peroxide works, but there's also colloidal silver, nitric oxide. Do you know in Finland, they actually have a antibody spray against SARS-CoV-2. There's a ton of innovation because it's a nasal infection. Everybody starts out with nasal congestion and loss of taste and smell. It's a nasal infection. Unless we treat the nasal infection early, we let it take off in the body. That's the reason why there's such a focus there. But the government actually actively suppressed monoclonal antibodies. They sabotaged the supply chain. They sequentially took them off the market based on theoretical. Monoclonal antibodies were huge. Do you know in a paper by Hwang and colleagues published in JAMA, those lucky enough to receive monoclonal antibodies who are hospitalized, which is about 15% of cases, they did tremendously well in the hospital. Virtually no one died. Whereas those who did not receive monoclonal antibodies, Ben, those are the ones who were in the hospital forever, and sadly, many died. So not treating patients with monoclonal antibodies, a huge disaster. Another hospital disaster was Remdesivir. There, in November of 2020, World Health Organization came out, careful analysis, all the clinical trials were there, the WHO did the biggest trial. World Health Organization told the world, do not use remdesivir to treat COVID. It leads to more deaths, liver injury, and kidney failure. It was a very clear statement. It was backed up by the European Society of Critical Care. They had human ethicists, everyone agreed. The biggest mistake is countries worldwide, particularly the United States, continue to use remdesivir, despite it leading to more deaths. That's an unforgivable move by the Department of Health and Human Services. And what made it happen is they put a 20% bonus on the entire hospital bill if hospitals use the 5-day course of remdesivir. We've never seen that before. If I give a 5-day course of antibiotics to somebody in the hospital, hospital wouldn't get a bonus just because I used a particular antibiotic. I mean, that's the biggest conflict of interest and the biggest perverse incentive of all time. I think historians are going to write about it for a long time. So that was a government disaster. Another government disaster in response had to do with the suppression of oral therapies. And when we look backwards, none of the drugs were perfect, but hydroxychloroquine did have a beneficial effect. Ultimately, 24 countries picked it up as in their guidelines as first-line treatment. Ivermectin, I think, had a bigger effect once we got to the weight-based of 600 micrograms per kilogram. Again, several dozen countries picked that up as first-line approach, all supported by dozens and dozens of randomized trials. Both of those were actually actively sabotaged. The FDA said, do not use hydroxychloroquine, period. They never re-looked at it. The NIH pulled their hydroxychloroquine studies. For ivermectin, both the FDA, the NIH, and the CDC, and then the American Medical Association, by the fall of 2020, had an active campaign to sabotage ivermectin. They were tweeting out that it's only a horse paste and you shouldn't use it. The American Medical Association launched a campaign, an official campaign, to abolish the use of ivermectin. And I can tell you, a medical society that has nothing to do with drug treatments trying to abolish the use of ivermectin when it was community standard of care is unconscionable. I mean, that's just as bad as remdesivir. You know, how did that ever happen? But it didn't stop there. Paxlovid came out. And Paxlovid was widely used. It came out of clinical trials, relatively small trials by Pfizer. But people age 45, unvaccinated, and it did reduce hospitalization and death. Yet the widespread use of Paxlovid was in the fully vaccinated who were getting COVID. And there, Paxlovid rebound started to happen. It happened in President Biden, happened in Anthony Fauci. In the treatment of COVID, the community doctors have never found single drugs work. We have to use drugs in combination. So both of those individuals got single dosing of monotherapy of Paxlovid. They developed rebound. The problem with rebound is you get better for a while after 5 days and get worse. And then in fact, patients have another course of COVID. And in the published studies that are cited in the CDC Health advisory. This is so bad. The CDC came out with a health advisory on May 24th, 2022. The CDC said, don't use Paxlovid in people who've been fully vaccinated because of rebound. And you basically doubled the duration of having COVID and you double the infectivity of COVID. And so so that mistake went out there, and we saw officials get the mistake again. So they get another course of Paxlovid as a solution to the rebound. They should have switched over to a multi-drug therapy. I had a patient in my office have Paxlovid rebound. It's the first one I saw, by the way, in an unvaccinated patient. I put him on 30 days of hydroxychloroquine. He did fine. You see these gross errors being made, and they were on the side of suppressing effective early treatment, virucidal washes, monoclonal antibodies, and oral drugs that are used in combination. And then we saw the disastrous advent of mass vaccination. And, the errors of basically willful blindness to safety and the relatively rapid push from a public health offering that could be considered into something that people had to face in terms of a mandate.
So I'm going to take that as both political / government, but also medical mismanagement, both. And I think this leads to my next question. Our colleagues seem to be getting their information from this same government that you're pointing out is making some egregious errors. So, again, just your opinion, these colleagues that aren't treating patients the way we would. In fact, I just had one today. Had a lady call me, her mother and father, both sick with COVID, vaccinated and boosted, down in Snyder, in remdesivir. They're refusing ivermectin, giving her remdesivir. Had another patient call. He's been to 3 different Walgreens here locally in Lubbock. Can't get ivermectin, but they're more than happy to hand out Paxlovid, but are refusing, downright refusing to fill a prescription for ivermectin. Is it just that these colleagues and pharmacists and fellow physicians, are they just reading their newsletters from the AMA and the CDC and the FDA or these various institutions and just not able to go find this independent research or aren't dialed into anything outside of that government-sponsored newsletters that I'm assuming they're getting from these various institutions? Or what do you think as far as our colleagues' lack of ability to see this at this point going on 3 years?
Well, think about the messaging from the top. The message on the top isn't, hey, docs, do everything you can to keep people out of the hospital. They've never said that. The messaging from the very top, the CDC, NIH, and FDA, you can add in the American Medical Association. The messaging on ivermectin is, do not use it. In fact, we want to abolish the use. That's very strong messaging. So when you're a pharmacist and you're looking at that and you're saying, listen, we are getting the strongest messaging possible to not use a drug. The question has to be asked, what is the source of that messaging from the top? Because whatever the pharmacists are doing, it's, that's a flow down to their level, and in many ways they're caught. But that is an extraordinary realization that we have, that we have this type of this top-down messaging that is, it's what it's fundamentally doing for the first time in medicine. It's actually interfering with community standard of care. And on June 27th, 2022, I had a chance to testify in the Texas Senate for the second time, and I know you've testified there as well. And I told the Committee on Health and Human Services, I told them that there is something called community standard of care. And community standard of care is defined by doctors in the community who have found a way to treat a problem. And it's what they found to be useful. And it varies from community to community. In some community standards of care, there may be particularly a surgical approach, let's say for back pain. And another community standard of care in another community may be more of a physical therapy or medical. I mean, it varies from community to community, but it's established by the doctors in the community. And I said for COVID, because it was a novel coronavirus, the community standard of care was established by the very first doctor in a community who started to treat COVID, and then others started to treat it. But whatever that ambulatory standard was, the doctors created it. It's what they found to be useful. Community standards of care are never established by the CDC, NIH, or FDA. They're never established by the AMA. They're not policed or established by pharmacies. They're established by doctors. And so, and actually even state medical boards have no role in determining the community standard of care. Yet all of those entities wanted to play a prohibitive role in the development of any community standard of care for outpatient COVID-19 from the very beginning. So with everything pushing against having an outpatient community standard of care, sadly, those who ended up in the hospital and died, majority, they did so as a product of not receiving early treatment. So you know, that's where we are now. So I lectured them on community standard of care. And the second thing I lectured them on is very important, is duty to treat. Duty to treat. When a patient has a condition, in this case, potentially life-threatening condition, the doctor who's notified has a duty to treat. And if the doctor can't treat the illness, has a duty to refer. It's a duty. When the pharmacist gets a prescription order in, there is a duty to fill that prescription. And if the pharmacist can't do it, there's a duty to get that prescription over to another pharmacist who can. So not only did we see undermining of the community standard of care, but we actually saw people failing in their duty to treat.
Unbelievable. And I can say firsthand, and I typically tend to stay pretty level-headed and cool and calm and peaceful. I try to, but this pharmacist down in the Hill Country area, one of our patients was down there, and this was last year, and he was very, very sick, probably one of the sickest outpatients we had. Couldn't get off his belly. He was in bed laying face down. His oxygen saturations would drop into the 60s and just couldn't catch his breath. Luckily, he had access to some home health nurses with IV vitamin C. We've got, but I called in the ivermectin. The pharmacist refused it. We were able to get him oxygen at the bedside. He refused to go to the hospital. So we had oxygen at the bedside, IV fluids for him. Budesonide, but the pharmacist refused the ivermectin, and she and I got into an argument about it, and she just point blank came out and said, "This isn't worth losing my license over." She was saying she was willing to put a patient's life at risk because she didn't want to feel that in fear of her license being pulled. And I think that's a fear in a lot of professionals. If they get out of line with what their administrators or whatever institution is paying their paycheck, they've got to stay in line.
Well, the other thing that tells you something's wrong is the great variability. So in that vignette, you've got a pharmacist who's absolutely refusing to fill ivermectin. And there's a perception that the pharmacy license would be on the line. Now, to my knowledge, no pharmacist has had their license threatened or even had their license pulled because of that. Doctors' licenses have been threatened because they've, you know, prescribed ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. That's happened. But the pharmacists have been free of any risk, to my knowledge. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is, think about the variability. I just had on my podcast, the McCullough Report on America Out Loud Talk Radio, I just had Denise Sibley. She's an internist in Johnson City, Tennessee. And she has probably nearly two dozen collaborative pharmacy agreements that she worked out with the state, where patients who are COVID positive can show their COVID test and they can pick up ivermectin from the pharmacy without a doctor's prescription in Johnson City, Tennessee. And you know, she went to the Capitol, she lobbied, it's on her license. She said, "Hey, listen, I'm responsible." And so the ivermectin is flowing in Johnson City. A similar arrangement is nearly over the finish line in New Hampshire. And obviously, you go to Mexico and other places, you just buy it over the counter. People buy large amounts of ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine through mail order pharmacies, just buy them directly since it's over the counter in other countries. And anything that's over the counter in another country, you can buy if you want to. So these examples of, you know, great variability. Listen, it's the same illness in Texas and Tennessee. Why is the pharmacy behavior on ivermectin so different? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the questions Americans should be asking.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good time to take a break, Dr. McCullough, real quick, and then we will be back to dive into the next topic. You already mentioned it. The COVID-19 vaccine, some people refuse to call vaccine injection gene therapy, but we're going to talk about that when we get back from the break. Everybody, we were listening to Dr. Peter McCullough today. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. Check out the archive page, veritasmedical.com. You can go back to last July, I think it was the 27th. Listen to the first interview with Dr. McCullough. And we have many other great guests, so check that out or on iTunes under You're the Cure. We will be right back with Dr. Peter McCullough. Stick with us. Okay, everybody, we are back. Thank you for sticking with us. Dr. Peter McCullough is our guest today. We're talking everything COVID. I guess we should probably throw a little monkeypox in there too, because it was just declared a national emergency. And then we'll maybe dive into the vaccine topic real quick. But any quick thought on monkeypox, Dr. McCullough?
Monkeypox, we now are at about 7,000 cases in the United States. A very important paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, first authors by Thornhill and colleagues. And it's some very good epidemiology. This is what we know. In of the worldwide cases, as a baseline, there's about 1,000 cases per year that come out of Africa and the Congo Basin, and it's largely from animals spreading to humans. Now, it can be monkeys to humans, but also Congo pouch rats and other organisms, other mammals can have it. It's a zoonosis. It spreads to people who handle these animals. So it's 1,000 cases per year is the baseline. And as we there's been going on for decades and decades and decades. There was a small U.S. outbreak, I believe, in 2003. About 50 or so people got it when the pouch rats were handled with some pet animals, pet prairie dogs, and kids and other people got it. One thing we learned from the U.S. outbreak is that it's basically a skin rash. It lasts for a few weeks. There's no deaths. And that was what was known back at that time. Now, fast forward, we got this 1,000 cases out of the Congo. Well, sure enough, somebody contracted it. And in some large parties, some raves of men who have sex with men in Europe, gay and bisexual men, there started to be this sexually transmitted disease pattern transmission. And then it really took off from there. And in the paper by Thornhill and colleagues, they have found that 98% of monkeypox is in gay or bisexual men who have sex with men. 95% of the transmission is by oral or anal intercourse of a man with a man. And that 41% of cases, they also have HIV. So there's a degree of immune compromise. And so that is the state of affairs with monkeypox. And there is a very good drug to treat it. It's called TPOXX or tecovirimat. It's been around for a few years. It's an oral cell surface receptor inhibitor. It's safe and effective. It's also available intravenously. There was a case in Dallas last summer. It was published by Rao and colleagues. This gentleman actually came from the Congo. He wasn't didn't have any. This is before the entry into the gay community. He just was a guy from Africa, probably got it from an animal. But the point is, he didn't have any gay or homosexual contact that was reported. He did have lots of casual contact with other people, both in Atlanta and Dallas, Ben. And you know what? He didn't spread it to anybody. He was treated with TPOXX in the hospital, got better, and that was it. And that was written up by Rao and published in MMWR in April of 2022. Since that time, there's been cases in Dallas. There was one at our hospital just last week. In our hospital, it was a woman, but who had advanced untreated HIV. And it was in kind of an oral sex transmission pattern. The lesions are typically painful oral or anal lesions. That's the only reason to hospitalize somebody. Otherwise, we could treat them at home with TPOXX. So monkeypox is a condition where the main interventions, in my perspective, are just safe sex education and availability of TPOXX, both oral and IV. That's my perspective. The U.S. has taken a different perspective. The U.S. government has declared a national emergency on monkeypox. They have already made emergency orders of a monkeypox vaccine as the main response. So they haven't said much about using TPOX. It's all about a vaccine. So what do we know about the vaccine? It's by a company called Bavarian Nordic, the Jynneos vaccine. They've had more than a half a dozen clinical trials. It's never actually been proven to stop monkeypox. It's only been proven to generate antibodies against smallpox and monkeypox. So it's still not a proven approach. It does cause heart damage. This is very important. Since the population at risk is the gay male population, it does cause heart damage. And the important points there is that the at-risk group for heart damage are those with HIV, as well as with those who have already had the smallpox vaccine. Now, we know in papers from Simpson and Beer, published in 2019, that most people over age 50 in the U.S. population have had smallpox. I check with my mom to make sure I know I've had smallpox vaccine. So fortunately, those who've had the smallpox vaccine are not at risk to get monkeypox. And to just go ahead and get the monkeypox vaccine is going to just risk heart damage with no benefit. But the monkeypox vaccine is being featured. It's being offered in several cities around the world. There's been some scares already in a daycare center, and then those who've touched clothing and money about fomite transmission, which has not been proven. Looks like it's still basically sexually transmitted disease. But there probably will be a push for vaccination. I'm greatly concerned, given the heightened cardiac risks, particularly in the HIV population. So I hope the data are followed. The other concern about the HIV population, Ben, is that the vaccine is a live attenuated double-stranded DNA vaccine. And so if we give a live attenuated vaccine to somebody who's immunocompromised, like an HIV patient, typically we're not supposed to do that. We actually could cause the disease. So if there's an effort to go vaccinate the HIV population, we actually may cause monkeypox by doing that.
Well, that would probably be kind of in line with the logic that we've been seeing with the COVID-19 vaccine, which we'll shift into that now. And I just want to read a few headlines. This is just really from the last week to 10 days. Australia, 96% vaccinated, 70% of those are boosted in Australia, and now they've just set record highs for COVID deaths. There's a Dr. Luke McClendon down. He's the head of fertility services at Mater Hospital in Brisbane, Australia. He came out and said 74% of pregnancies are ending in miscarriage. Another headline, 5 Canadian doctors were dead within a 6-week period of time. It's right after the fourth booster mandate had rolled out. 4 of those doctors were less than 50 years old. One of those doctors was a very in-shape athlete, young lady in her 20s, I believe 28. Twitter censors Pfizer injured Israeli COVID vaccine director. Another headline here, German health insurance insurers announced 1 in 25 of the people insured by this German health insurer, 1 in 25 underwent some sort of treatment for a vaccine side effect. Harvey Risch, I saw in a recent interview, said expect insurance companies, and he's talking about life insurance companies, to sue vaccine companies because of the huge payouts, early payouts of young people dying. A new poll just out, and I think I saw this on your Telegram page, Dr. McCullough, of vax deaths versus COVID deaths, and the vax deaths outnumber the COVID deaths in this telephone poll. That's just a few of the headlines. It's just this overwhelming avalanche of data, of all-cause mortality data, side effect data. I mean, at this point, it seems just like there's not that there was really a question even from the get-go, but honestly, I'm scratching my head thinking, how is this not malpractice to be offering these still? Why are these still on the market? How can a physician recommend this today, August of 2022, and it not be considered malpractice based off all of the evidence that's accumulated from around the world? What say you to any of those headlines or on this topic in general?
Boy, let me toss in a couple more points. Let me just say a quote from the former President Trump early in the pandemic when he said, let's not make the cure worse than the disease. And in this case, the cure, the COVID-19 vaccines are in based on the data are just the worse than the disease itself. I'll give you some more updates. The Zogby survey company has done a survey. They're a valid survey company, very highly respected, of a wide sample. And they found 2/3 of Americans that they sampled took one of the vaccines. Now, those who took the vaccine, 15% have some new medical problem. Heart damage, blood clots, blood system problems, autoimmune problems, neurologic problems, ringing in the ears, headaches, hearing loss, blindness. 15% injury rate in the Zogby survey. It's cohesive what German health insurers are reporting. And all of the information agrees. Pantazatos and Seligman, through December of 2021, this is after the last time I came on your podcast, they had estimated that the upper limit of the confidence interval through December of 2021 of those who died with the vaccine was about 187,000. It was approaching 200,000 people. Our CDC VAERS system has about 13 to 14,000 Americans that the CDC certifies have died shortly after the vaccine, and that could be 100-fold underreported. So the number could be much larger. June 11th, 2022, the World Council for Health, huge international organization, issued a pharmacovigilance report, and they combined the CDC VAERS system, the UK Yellow Card system, the EU UGIS system, and the WHO VigiSafe system together. Again, this is a gross underreporting, but these are at least the certified deaths that the agency said happened. And those who took the vaccine, number over 40,000. This is stunning. You combine those four databases, just a handful of deaths with any prior vaccine that was pulled off the market. I mean, these are stunning numbers. And there is willful blindness by the government agencies. And we know this, and here's the best example. Through court-ordered documents, Pfizer was forced to release what they knew about the vaccine once it was released, and their dossier. And Pfizer had recorded 1,223 deaths that occurred shortly after their vaccine within 90 days of release. Now, in this court proceeding, the FDA, the lawyer for the FDA, they did not want to release that information to American public for 55 years. So that's prima facie evidence that the FDA, the American government, is in an active cover-up on a serious drug safety issue. I finished up a conference called Crony Capitalism in Washington last week with Senator Ron Johnson, Pierre Corey, Robert Malone, and it was held by the Federalist in the Hillsdale unit in Washington. And Senator Johnson presented the data. 80% of these deaths and injuries are linked to specific lots of vaccine. And what Johnson said is that he's a former manufacturing executive. He says, we've got a product problem. When you put all this together, it's impossible for this not to be a product problem. There's a problem. Now, people have said, the deaths aren't caused by the vaccine. And what we know now with 1,000 papers in the peer-reviewed literature, Ben, 1,000, the vaccine is causing these deaths. There are fatal cases of myocarditis where at autopsy, the pathologists and the coroners conclude the vaccines killed the patients. There are fatal cases of vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura with intracranial hemorrhage. There's a paper by Burhill and colleagues from three Nordic countries published in JAMA with Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. And they carefully ruled out none of these people had COVID, the illness, at all. Just with the vaccines, within 28 days, 7,750 intracranial hemorrhages and strokes. Patients who are neurologically devastated. So it's pouring in the peer-reviewed literature. It's in the safety databases. It's in the observational studies. And as you pointed out, it's in the life insurance data. So it's all cohesive. The vaccines are leading to mass numbers of deaths, and the vaccines are the cause of death. When we apply the Bradford Hill criteria, which has been applied to smoking and lung cancer and so many other illnesses. There's a dangerous mechanism of action. The vaccines install the genetic code, which is long-lasting, for the lethal Wuhan spike protein, which was engineered in a biosecurity lab in Wuhan, China. The spike protein is produced for an uncontrolled duration of time, an uncontrolled quantity, and if patients get a lot of a vaccine that has very viable genetic material, it could be and probably is going to be fatal. It's internally consistent that, in fact, these heart attacks, strokes, and other things are consistent with the fact that, they are part of a cascade of that leads to death. It's externally consistent. All the databases agree. It's a very large signal. These are big numbers. And that it's temporally associated. Most of these occur with just in a few days of taking the shot. And from a regulatory perspective, anything that occurs within 30 days of taking a new product, it counts. You don't even have to prove causality. Anything within 30 days, it's due to the product, period. And then finally, the randomized trials. The largest randomized trials program is Pfizer. And with Pfizer, there's slightly more deaths with Pfizer than placebo. So all the Bradford Hill criteria have been fulfilled. On a more probable than not, and probably in a clear and convincing level of evidence, the vaccines are causing large numbers of deaths.
What about the claim early on that, quickly we learned that it didn't prevent transmission, but the risk of severe disease, hospitalization, and death. What can we say about that claim?
Well, there's been three false claims for the vaccine program, besides being a safety disaster. Remember, when things are unsafe, it doesn't matter what the efficacy claims are. They should have been off the market because of these large numbers of deaths and non-fatal injuries. So safety always takes priority over efficacy. But the three false efficacy claims were that the vaccine stopped COVID. And the president said that, what have you. They obviously don't. Second false claim is they stopped transmission. Well, our CDC director got out there mid last year and said, listen, they don't stop transmission. And there's equal amounts of viral load in the nose in people who've taken the vaccine or not. Papers by Chow, Acharian, Reimer, Isma, and Accorsi all showed that. And then the final false claim is it makes the syndrome milder. It reduces hospitalization and death. I can tell you there's not been a single randomized trial that's demonstrated reductions in hospitalizations and deaths where that's a primary endpoint. There's not a single valid observational study that shows that. It's simply wishful thinking. So we've had three false claims on efficacy. And the most common thing that people will say if you confront them about mortality, they'll say, well, listen, large numbers of people are dying with the vaccine. But they'll say, well, COVID's a bad disease, and how many people died of COVID? I had a patient tell me that last week, Ben. We were talking about this. I said, listen, our CDC is verifying 13,000 Americans have died with the vaccine. She said, 13,000? How many people died with COVID? So, people in their mind are weighing off death at the end of a needle and death with COVID. And it's just not a correct thing to do. Because as we've pointed out, so many of the deaths were preventable with early treatment. The other thing is that, 90% of the deaths occur to people towards the end of their life with other comorbidities. 75% had four or more other problems. With the COVID-19 vaccines, we're talking about deaths among young people. You pointed out young Canadian doctors. There's now actually a roster that the whole country's collecting now. They've from the update you've given, they've actually had about 30 young doctors. It seems like when they hit the fourth shot, that's when much of the deaths occur. Mm-hmm. But this is an ongoing biological disaster. And, the toughest question I had when Joe Rogan, I was on his podcast, of which, by the way, I'm the all-time record holder on Joe Rogan. You're talking to him.
Congratulations.
Not Elon Musk. Elon Musk or anybody else. Anyhow, the toughest question I got is, well, listen, McCullough, if these vaccines are so bad, how come everybody doesn't die after them? Mm. He just asked the exaggerated question, which is useful. And the answer is now, working with a lot of molecular biologists, what have you, is I think most people are getting relatively inactive shots, inert shots. These were supposed to be super cooled, single-use vials. Now they're not super cooling it. They're trying to use different buffers. They are using multi-use vials. Lots of needles are being poked in them. The things get oxygenated. These lipid nanoparticles are very unstable. The messenger RNA is very unstable. I think most people are not getting very good genetic material. So they're getting a sore arm. they don't get much immunity, but they don't die of their shot. But those who get these good lots, remember 80% of the deaths occur in specific lots, those are ones that from the very beginning came out of the factory with high quality messenger RNA. They were handled correctly, they were cooled correctly, they got to the right place, and they got used correctly. And I think when someone gets a correct, high quality COVID-19 vaccine, watch out. They are in the crosshairs for a blood clot, myocarditis, death. It's a disaster, and we're seeing this every day in our clinic.
It's really sad. So, and you can decline to answer this because I know you like to say very professional, but I've heard people say unprofessional things about you. And any physician that's recommending this injection at this point, and especially kids, we haven't even really talked about down to 6 months old now, EUA on these kids for this shot. How can that not be malpractice?
Well, it violates the Hippocratic Oath for sure, right? So Hippocratic Oath says primum non nocere, that in fact we have to operate on the principle of beneficence, that we have to put our patient's best interest first. The Hippocratic Oath is written a long time ago, but it says, I will not give my patient any poison. It says that right in the Hippocratic Oath. So doctors are violating the Hippocratic Oath. They're violating the Nuremberg Code, which says for, you know, something new that's a research item that we can't promote it. We certainly can't encourage someone to be in research. That's, you can only show them the risks and the benefits. So they're violating that. And, you know, the question is, are they violating the community standard of care? Now, if they're violating the community standard of care, that's considered malpractice. But if all the doctors are recommending the vaccine, then they're not violating the standard of care. What do we know there? 96% of doctors took the vaccines, Ben. 96%. They took them early. And in a recent Texas A&M survey, 10% of doctors don't think they're safe and effective. But many, they do it confidentially, but many are afraid to come out and say it. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are right now. I think there's some type of psychological phenomenon that occurs when someone takes a vaccine. I'll give you an example. My last patient I had of the day was, there was a 19-year-old boy. He went to college. He's brought in by a concerned mother. He's already taken two vaccines. And the only thing she wanted me to do is talk to him about the dangers of the vaccine. So we went over everything that you and I just went over. And then we started talking, you know, more informally about the psychology of this. And then I asked the mother, I said, are you alarmed that large numbers of people are dying after the vaccine? And she goes, of course I'm alarmed. I think this is atrocious. Then I asked the boy, I said, why are you not alarmed? Why are you not alarmed? He looked at me point blank. He had already taken two of the shots. He goes, I don't know. He goes, I can't tell you. So people who have taken these vaccines are not alarmed that large numbers of people are dying with the vaccine. There's some type of psychological factor going on. It's almost as if they're in a trance, that they're in some type of hypnosis, what's called mass formation. This kid was honest. He looked at me point blank. He looked completely unconcerned. And he said he doesn't know why he doesn't have concern. Isn't it staggering?
Yeah, it is.
I've heard the rationalization. Well, listen, you're either going to die with the vaccine or die with COVID. So I've just taken my chance. I'm going to, you know, take the vaccine. I've heard all different types of rationalization. Now, there certainly are plenty of people who are remorseful. A recent New York Times piece about two months ago, said that 35% of Americans are not going to take the vaccine or not take a booster. Our CDC says 82% of people took at least one shot. So that means there's 18% who never had anything in them, and you must have another 17% who took at least one or two shots and said they're not going to take anymore. But that's a third of the country that's dug in, Ben. And that third of the country, the people who haven't taken the vaccine now, I don't think there's any convincing them.
Have you seen data on the children? What percentage of children have taken them?
The number I know is the uptake is 2%. So the children, you know, and that can be considered a public health victory. Despite all the messaging there, the parents just didn't go for it. And, there was gross regulatory malfeasance. Do you know the Moderna, when they put in their application, They had 4% vaccine efficacy, ages 6 months to 5 years. 4%. Remember, a 50% protection is the bare minimum we would accept to even take a vaccine. 50%. And it should last for a year. So the flu shot last year was completely unacceptable. It had 16% protection. So many people are going to decline the flu shot because it's had progressively less protection. You just can't accept a vaccine that has a vaccine efficacy less than 50%. It's unacceptable. That means that any little side effect that you could have with a vaccine far outweighs any possible benefit.
Yeah. Well, kind of a little tangent, but you mentioned the flu vaccine. I've heard you also speak about the pneumonia vaccine. Do you have a comment on that, efficacy of that?
Yeah, recently published in JAMA, the 13-valent pneumococcal vaccine, I think that was the Pneumovax, that came out. They finally had an outcomes analysis for protection against pneumococcal hospitalization and death. You know what the answer was? 9%. And I have to tell you, I'm an internist. I pushed that vaccine. We were told to get everybody Pneumovax over age 65, and we got pneumococcal vaccines going. We pushed it. We featured it everywhere. 9%, Ben. I can tell you, a shot in the arm doesn't protect much of anything in the nasopharynx and the lungs. It really doesn't.
Yep. So flu shot, 16%, pneumonia shot, 9%, COVID shot, 0.
Well, all experts agree with the Omicron variant, there's essentially negligible coverage. That's the reason why all the manufacturers said they have to come out with new vaccines. Now, they promised the Omicron vaccines in March of 2022, and they didn't deliver. Now they're said to be coming in the fall. They have changed the rules now. They're not going to do any more clinical studies. They're just going to do immunobridging studies to show they can raise antibodies. The antibodies are not a trustworthy surrogate. So people with these COVID antibodies after the vaccine, they're not a trustworthy surrogate on whether or not they're going to prevent COVID, primarily because their antibodies measured in blood. And what you really need to know is, are there IgA antibodies in the sinuses, and is there active T cell immunity in the sinuses? And chances are with the vaccines, you don't have either one. So I have to tell you, I think the vaccine program is going to be in trouble this fall. And I'm a little bit worried about, you know, doubling or tripling and quadrupling down and telling everybody they have to take a new COVID vaccine where there's no clinical evidence that they actually do anything.
Yeah. Well, Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for all this information and data. It's great to have you back. We just have a couple minutes left. I'd be remiss if I didn't obviously say thank you for all you've done. You've encouraged so many. I would say responsible for so many lives saved, I can't even begin to count, just not only from the published guidelines on early outpatient treatment, but the continual acceptance of interviews like this one, when I know you're a working man and a family man. I mean, you have kiddos, and I'm sure you're tired, and of course the attacks have come, and you know, I didn't even give you the proper initial introduction when we started the show, but you're a household name by now because of all the times you've said yes to all the interviews, all the testifying amongst various government agencies. But, you know, I know some of those initials behind your name, that when I first interviewed you a year ago, some of those have been taken away. So I know there's been, you know, personal and professional persecution here. So from a personal standpoint, how are you doing? Where does this leave you at? Your profession? I mean, do you look at your profession? Do you just want to throw in the towel sometimes? Humanity in general? I mean, you've been through a lot. So from a personal standpoint, I wanted you to touch on that. Maybe encourage those out there.
Yeah, I can tell you it's tempting. I'm nearing retirement age, but I feel I have a lot more to give. And we're at such a time of crisis in our country. If doctors and that patient I described, if they are blinded to really what's happening in terms of safety, and if they really can't see it, and large numbers of people are taking these vaccines and dying and having blood clots and heart damage, it's like doctors not being able to recognize tuberculosis or not being able to recognize cancer. We're in trouble, and people have asked the question, people have asked the question, how long will it take for this recognition? And, I'm going to tell you something that's not very encouraging, but it's an example. From the time that Sir Austin Bradford Hill epidemiologically concluded that smoking caused lung cancer to the broad acceptance that smoking caused lung cancer in the community, 40 years. Mm. 40 years. And doctors were smoking in the hospital, in the operating room, in the exam room. 40 years, Ben, before there was acceptance. They were willfully blind to the effects of smoking on the human body. Willfully, doctors were willfully blind. It's very, very important. Another example, opioids, the opioid pandemic. We've heard so much about the opioid pandemic. From the start of the widespread promotion of opioids that started with the companies and nurses making pain a fifth vital sign and all of that, till the capitulation that opioids have caused more harm than good, 25 years. So we're now in the second year of the vaccine. I just hope it's not a 25 or 40 year sojourn. But physicians do not have a good track record on recognizing things that are going bad. Yeah. The whole opioid thing went bad. Smoking was a habit that went bad, yeah. and people did not recognize it.
Well, I think with more and continual efforts by you and others, hopefully we'll have more and more of our colleagues recognize that. I know a lot of the public is coming around. I've had a number of vaccinated folks tell me never again, and really a lot of regret. So I think we're making some headway, no small part, thanks to you and all your efforts. So appreciate
you. Well, thanks. Oh, well, Ben, I just want to quickly mention that so much of what we talked about is in my new book, Courage to Face COVID-19. Yes. It's available on Amazon. You're in the book. And I can tell you that, that example of lung cancer and the opioid pandemic are in there. It's a story. It's not a COVID book. It's actually a story about large crimes that are being committed, both fraud and mass negligent homicide. Who are the perpetrators? The government agencies and big pharma, various foundations like the Gates Foundation. And we lay it all out in the book. It's a narrative. It's a story. It's important. It's not a medical book. It's a story because this is a very complex reality. This is the first time where actions by the government are actually hurting the people in a massive way. And so many people are having the hardest time coming to grips with this. And so this is a must read. It's ranked number one, typically, in viral diseases, communicable diseases, and true crime on Amazon. We're doing book promotions many places. I'll be many places around Texas and nationally. And it's one of the most, it's co-written with John Leake, who's already a best-selling true crime author. So it's the only book on COVID that's actually written by a full-time author who writes really captivating books that you can read almost like a page turner. And so, books, it's hard to read books in today's day of compressed information and cell phones, what have you. But if you're going to sit down and read a book for a couple hours and have a real page turner, you'll see it there. And you did ask about me professionally. There is a chapter in there called The Stripping, where I am stripped of credentials. And people can just read it for themselves and have a sense that, is this fair? Was there due process done? Or, what is it about Dr. McCullough where he's such a high value target to strip everything away from him in public? So I'll leave it there. And thank you so much for having me on the program.
All right, Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for joining us, everybody. You've been listening to Dr. Ben Edwards with You're the Cure and Dr. Peter McCullough. Y'all check out his book, The Courage to Face COVID-19. Thank you, Dr. McCullough. We look forward to having you back someday.